Chapter 14. Mom and Dad were gray-faced when I knocked on the door. I tried to make a joke of it. I'd have thought you guys would be used to this by now. My voice cracked a little on the last couple words, and they gave me enormous hugs. They'd figured out where I was and confirmed it by calling my phone, which Dahlia had answered, telling them all about what had happened on the bus. Mom and Dad had dipped into their line of credit to pay a lawyer to start shouting at the SFPD about me, but she was only one of hundreds of lawyers so employed, and my parents had had no idea that I was released until I stumbled up the walk. I wanted to shower for 100 years. I wanted to sleep for a millennium. But before I did anything, I wanted to find Ange. "She got home 10 hours ago," Mom said. "But her mother said she went right back out to the chicken farm." That was what the press was calling the place we'd all been held, down in South San Francisco, the name coming from the camera phone photos that had already appeared online, making the place look like some kind of nightmarish poultry factory. No doubt Ange was waiting for me there, and I'd missed her in the horde. How the hell did people live before phones? "Can I borrow your phone?" I said. Mom handed it to me, and I spent a couple of moments unfogging my brain enough to get it to cough up Ange's phone number, which had been my first speed dial for years. "Have you heard from him?" she said as soon as she picked up. "Kind of," I said. "Where the hell are you?" "Home," I said. "What the hell are you doing there?" "Preparing to estivate," I said. Estivate is a very handy verb. It's a kind of hibernation, a prolonged state of torpor or dormancy, just where I was heading. "Not until I get there. How dare you get out of jail without my finding you?" "I know," I said. "I'm a rotter. Sorry, darling." "Have yourself bathed, waxed, perfumed, and put into bed. I'll be there in 35 minutes. "Aye, aye, Cap'n." The reunion, when it came, was just what I needed, and then some. Both of us had been hurt. Ange had been gassed and trampled, arrested and freed. And while her story had some minor variations in its specifics, it came out to about the same thing as mine. She'd been with Lemmy through most of the process. They'd stayed together somehow, Lemmy bodily lifting Ange free of the crowd at one point when the crushing started, holding her over his head like a freaky circus act. She'd seen him again after they were released and promised to call him as soon as she found me. We talked about it for a few minutes, kissing each other in the places where we were bruised or hurt, holding each other, murmuring to each other, until sleep took us. And the next day, I went to work. Well, of course I did. It was Tuesday, and the election was coming up, and someone had to get Joseph Noss elected, and it was going to be me. 100 times on the way to work, I reached for my phone to make a reminder for myself, to send a text to Ange, who was still sleeping in my bed. Her first class didn't start until after lunch. To check the weather for that night, to read what my tweeps had to say. Each time I thought, crap, I've lost my phone. Gotta call it from my laptop and talk to Dahlia and arrange to get it back from her. And then I thought, huh, I should really make a note about that. Now, where's my phone? And it began again. It was so funny, I forgot to laugh. I came through the door of the Jofer Senate office and stopped. Something was different. I couldn't put my finger on it at first, and then I realized what it was. Everyone was staring at me. Every single person in the office was watching me with owl-eyed intensity, giving off a mixture of awe and fear. I gave a little half-wave and took off my jacket and headed for my desk, plunked down in my seat, pulled out Lurch and plugged in my monitor and keyboard and mouse, and started entering the passwords that got my disks mounted and my network connection going. There was near total silence as I did this, and it was so unnerving that I fat-fingered my password twice before getting it. I sat down at my computer and started going through my start-of-day routine, downloading my email, checking the server log summaries to see if we were in danger of running out of bits, kicking off my own personal backups, station-keeping stuff I could have done while half asleep. I started off half asleep, or half distracted, and so it was only after a few minutes that I pounced on my mouse and started unclosing the browser tabs I'd just closed, hammering on Control-F12 with a series of whaps so hard I actually felt the spring under the key start to lose its sprungedness. I clicked and clicked again. Then I got up from my desk and looked into the sea of stairs. Can someone please explain to me what the hell's going on? As one, the whole office turned to look at Liam, who got up and came over to my desk. You want to get a cup of coffee? He said. I realized that that was exactly what I wanted, more than pretty much anything in the entire goddamned universe. I let him steer me up to Dolores Park, stopped at the Turks to get a cup to go, and a thermos full for after that. We perched on a bench and Liam waited patiently while I drank my first cup and poured myself a second one. Then he raised his eyebrows at me, silently asking if it was time to hear what he had to say. I nodded. Joe came into the office on Monday breathing fire. He kept asking where you were, getting Floor to call your phone, getting me to send you email. He had something he really, really wanted to talk to you about and he couldn't reach you, so finally he came and got me. He said I got computers and the internet and stuff and asked if I had access to our web thing. Well, I knew where you kept the sealed envelope with the admin password, so the answer was technically yes. Then he told me about what you'd suggested at the protest, hosting all those darknet docs. He couldn't believe that there were all these people in the streets of San Francisco pissed off about the kind of thing that was in those docs, but that they'd gotten practically no mainstream media publication and no one had made a political issue of it. He said that the Dems and the Republicans didn't want to start everyone thinking about how corrupt the system was, how money bought policy, how scummy the whole Sacramento scene was at the Statehouse. He'd been thinking about it all weekend and had decided that this was going to be the thing that made him different from the regular candidates. Floor tried to argue with him, but you know how he gets when he's sure about something. He was sure. So he tried to explain to me what you'd suggested, some kind of voting system or something. I couldn't really explain it. After a while, I said, look, I can pull down all the darknet docs and put them up on our server in a couple hours, but I have no idea how to do all this other stuff. And if I tried, I'd probably leave the whole thing in such an insecure mess that someone'd take it down and replace the whole site with pictures of penises in about 10 seconds flat. I winced. So, what did he say? He said that he'd rather beg forgiveness than ask permission and told me to just put all the docs up now and he'd take care of the rest. The next thing I knew, he was calling in the press team, and the next thing I knew after that, they were all checking to see if we could handle the capacity, if, like, millions of people all came to download the docs at once. I was like, yeah, I think. I mean, I knew we were on a cloud machine that could expand if we needed it. I tried calling the data center, but I didn't have your passphrase, so all they would tell me is that their servers could handle anything up to and including the entire state accessing us at once. Is that what happened? The server log showed that our traffic had hit over 1 million simultaneous connections overnight, and the rate was climbing. Oh no, he said. Worse. I mean, more. There was a lot of interest from out of state. At this rate, it's like the whole world wants to know about it. I mean, you've seen the news, right? It was the lead on every broadcast yesterday, and it's been trending on Twitter since about 10 seconds after it went live. We've all been waiting for you to come in and get some decent analytics for it. I tried, but... He shrugged. Well... I'm just a t-shirt guy, right? I took a really, really deep breath. I've been in jail. I figured, he said. That was the leading theory. Joe was going to try to find your parents today if you didn't show up. What happened to your phone, by the way? I've been calling and calling? It's a long story, I said. I wondered why Dahlia wasn't answering the phone anymore. Maybe she was answering calls where the return number showed up as Mom and ignoring the rest. Maybe the battery was dead. If that was the case, I wasn't going to be able to get my phone back until she got in touch with me. Great. Where's Joe? He's doing a press conference about this at Root Strikers, he said. They're an activist group that does something with getting the money out of politics. They're pretty excited about all this. Huh, I said, and reviewed what I'd just been told in my head. I mean, basically, they'd taken my idea and run with it. And it had worked out well. So far, anyway. I wondered how long it could last, and decided that wasn't my job. My job was to keep the website online, while Joe was off being Joe. The coffee was in my veins now, turning my thick, sluggish blood into quicksilver. It was time to go make some technology work. I was good at that. Meantime, though, what about the other thing? The vote-getting machine? Yeah, Liam said, that. He told me about it. But I couldn't really figure out what he was talking about. Something to mine your social media contacts? Basically, I said, and ran it down for him. Oh, he said, that is awesome. And we could use the whole thing as a decision-making process. Anytime some big campaign issue comes up, or after he's in office, get the whole Joe for Senate machine to have instant runoff polls to see what we should do. That sounds wicked. Are we doing that too? That depends on whether we can find the time now that the darknet docs are live. It's funny, even though the Darknet docs had basically taken over my life, I was a lot more excited about this vote-getting machine, and half wished that I could just focus on that. I'd have to find some time to do it. But first, I had to harden our infrastructure. I figured the first thing to do was get us spanned out across a lot of cloud servers. My predecessor had gotten us hosted on Amazon's cloud, which was as robust as they came, an inconceivable network of humming racks and data centers all over the world, overseen by lab-coded priests who could diagnose and swap out a faulty component in 2 minutes flat, fed by twisted fiber-optic bundles as thick as my arm, and cooled by enormous chillers with carbon footprints the size of cities. Amazon was a great choice if you wanted to get hosted by someone who'd keep your servers online, no matter how popular they got. However, they were a terrible choice for hosting your data if you were worried about the police going bug nuts on you. You see, the police don't necessarily know how to seize just one customer's data from a global network of server racks. If you're doing something with your data that was going to really interest the cops, then you had to be prepared for someone powerful calling up Amazon's lawyers and saying, "We need to investigate one of your customers, and since we don't know how to take one customer's data off your servers, we're coming over with a couple of 16-wheelers and taking it all away until we finish our investigations." Or, as the Godfather might have said,
"Nice cloud. It'd be a shame if something were to happen to it."
Amazon had a lot, so they had a lot to lose. And while they'd been a good choice for our nice, boring campaign site, they'd sucked at providing infrastructure for Ground Zero in the new info war. I'd heard a seminar about this from one of the Tor hackers at Noisebridge, and they'd mentioned a bunch of ballsy, free speech-oriented cloud providers that would take us on. They were the projects of eccentric weirdos, free speech nuts, bashed together hackerspace side projects, sketchy, sketchy services with one foot in the porn industry and the other in organized crime. Most of them couldn't take a credit card payment because they'd been cut off by everyone from American Express to Visa to MasterCard to PayPal. Instead, they'd received payment through wire transfers, Western Union money orders, and other weird and cumbersome measures. I groaned and face-palmed and went and talked to Floor about this. I'd been afraid to face Floor. I remembered her warning about dragging the campaign into anything leet and had a feeling that she was probably already furious with me. But I hadn't bargained on what it meant for the idea to come from Joe. Joe and Floor may have argued about this, but once Joe won the argument, Floor was behind him 100%. Like most of us, she was ready to march into the sun for him. And as soon as I made it clear why I needed her to take the campaign credit card down the street to a liquor store and buy a Western Union order for a random dude I didn't even know where he lived, she agreed. "Just let me talk to him first," she said. I had a moment's impatience because I felt like my parent wanted to look over my homework. Finding bulletproof web hosting was my department. But then she got on the phone with the guy I'd chosen and exchanged some quick IMs with and quickly negotiated better terms than I'd been able to get, including 30-day billing for our future bandwidth bills and a 24/7 cellular number for support calls. "Sounds like a good guy," she said, as she pulled on her jacket and picked up her purse and marched out into the mission to find a Western Union office. Joe got back in the late afternoon, just as I was finishing the switchover to our new host. I had set up two more backup clouds for us to move on to if we needed to, one in a country I'd never heard of in Central Asia. Floor had gone out for two more money orders, and I'd written the scripts to keep us all in sync. I also made sure to register a bunch of variants on our domain, jonasforsenate.com, in other countries, snagging the .se, Sweden, and the .nz, New Zealand, figuring that it would be a lot harder to convince two countries on the other side of the planet with totally different legal systems to nuke our DNS than it would be to just get VeriSign, who runs all the .com domains, to take down the U.S. version. Joe listened to me report on all this and nodded his head soberly.
"Marcus," he said, "I knew you'd be the right guy for this. Thanks for all the good thought and hard work you put into this. Now, Floor tells me you've been in jail. Were you at the chicken farm?"
I found that my voice had disappeared and tears had welled up behind my eyes. I nodded silently. Normally, Joe looked, well, statesmanlike is probably the best word for it. Like someone who might be photographed at any instant, and, if he was, would look as though he were carefully considering how to pilot the nation and its interests. But for an instant, Something flashed to the surface that I'd never seen on his face before. A momentary glimpse of something like an Old Testament prophet who's about to lay down some smiting on a foolish tribe that had strayed from a path. The fact that he felt that way on my behalf made it all the more powerful, made me like him even more.
Marcus, he said, I have been around the block a few times. I've seen all manner of brutalities inflicted in the name of public order and keeping the peace. But the premeditation of what happened to you and the others, the sheer militarization of it, he shook his head. All I can say is, it's not to be tolerated. The fact that the SFPD had prepared for the future of protest by buying fleets of gas-spraying drones and turning a Titanic building into an internment center? It can't stand. It won't. I'm sure you've heard about the class action suits pending against the city.
I hadn't, but then I hadn't been doing anything except trying to get our infrastructure secured.
As someone who served in this city's government for many years, I wouldn't blame you if you joined them.
Thank you, I said. The lump in my throat had gone down, and Joe had regained his normal statesman look. We were back to baseline.
Now, about these documents. I'm sorry if I stepped on your toes by having Liam work on this while you were away. He told me that he couldn't do as good a job as you could, but perfection wasn't as important as timeliness. There was a lot of interest in those documents after the demonstrations, and I felt that we could seize on that interest if we moved quickly.
I said, was he apologizing to me?
Well, it's your campaign, right? I'm not going to chew you out for running it the way you want to. He smiled. Yes, of course. But I hired you to do a job, and the last thing I want to do is make it harder for you to do that job.
I waved him off. I don't mind, really. But is it working? There was another flash, and I got a glimpse of Joe Noss the imp. The glee in his eyes was unmistakable.
Oh, it's working. I've gotten more airtime in the past 24 hours than I have for the whole campaign. Everyone seems to get the connection between the weekend's events and the documents we're publishing. We can barely keep up with the requests to act as official campaign volunteers, going through all that data and making sense of it. I only check in a few times a day, but from what I hear, there's plenty there for Sacramento and the rest of the country to chew on. My advisory committee squawked, and one of them quit. They're worried, sensibly enough, that there's stuff in that archive that could expose us to liability, and they're right to worry. I tried to explain to Liam what you'd suggested about this, but he spread his hands and shrugged.
I know, I said. He told me. I've been giving that some thought. I bet I can get it up now, though. I was going to try to do the moderation system tonight, see if I couldn't bang together something that would only show the public the checked documents. Sounds like we could use the volunteers to go through what's left pretty quickly, assuming you trust them. And then we're going to get to work on this vote-getting machine, somewhere for all that positive energy to go.
I trust them to do a better job than is being done now, he said. They're substantially better than nothing. But Marcus, you have been in jail. You've been gassed. You've been beaten. And I don't expect you to work through the night, too.
I shrugged. It's not that hard, I said. I mean, no big deal. I've pulled plenty of all-nighters, and he held his hands up, and I fell silent.
Let me put this another way. As your employer, I don't want you to work on this until you've gotten a good night's sleep and had a chance to see your loved ones and start to recover from your trauma. It's not a request, Marcus. It's an order.
Part of me wanted to argue, but I told that part to shut up. Yes, sir, I said.
Good man, he said. But if you should want to stay a little late tonight and possibly turn up a little early tomorrow, I wouldn't take it amiss.
Yes, sir, I said.
Good man, he repeated.
Mom and Dad were surprisingly cool about everything. I tried about 6 Skype calls to my old phone, but Dahlia wasn't answering. Finally, I gave up and dialed into it and picked up my voicemail. About 1,000,000 messages from Mom, Dad, Ange, Liam, Floor, and Joe, preceded by a series of panicked calls from a woman speaking Arabic, whom I took to be Dahlia's mother, who must have had kittens when her conversation with her daughter was so rudely cut short and redialed my number. Then I found an old phone and brought its firmware up to date and stuck in a pay-as-you-go SIM I bought at the Walgreens down the hill and changed the outgoing voicemail on the old phone to a message telling people to use this number until I could get a new SIM from my phone carrier. I did work a little on Joe's darknet moderation site before bed, despite what he'd said, because while Joe was a nice guy to insist, the darknet was my project, and just because I was working on it, it didn't mean I was working on it for him. I worked until the muscles that allowed my eyes to focus on my screen went on strike, blinked hard, brushed my teeth, stripped off, and fell face first into bed amid all the junk I'd dropped there, not even feeling the sharp corners that dug into me. I was 99.9999% of the way to Sleepyland when my eyes opened so fast I heard the click of my eyelids ungumming. Lemmy's quadcopter. We put it in the sky just before the gas attacks on the crowd, after the police thought that every camera had been killed. The tweet telling people where to look for its feed hadn't gone out, but that didn't mean it didn't create and store that feed. I pounced on my laptop, and after a few minutes dicking around, found the file I was looking for. It was all in ghostly night vision monochrome, with false color splotches of orange and red where the people gathered. The SFPD stood out hotter than the rest, with bright red splotches on their hands and feet. I wonder if they were using boot and glove warmers. We didn't get the firing of the Herf gun on the camera, but we did get some amazing footage of the gas blimp setting sail, moving into position like sinister circus balloons, unleashing their chemical rain, a kind of gray static that fell on the screaming, terrified crowd below. The gassing went on and on and on. Different blimps releasing at different times, filling the air with wave after wave of choking chemical droplets. I'd lived through this on the ground, but I hadn't seen it, not the way I could see it now. Watching thousands and thousands and thousands of Americans of all stripes choking and falling down, kids, moms, dads, old, young, writhing, crawling over one another, vomiting, screaming. I know that worse things have happened. I know that bombs have fallen on cities, mustard gas sent over trenches, people machine-gunned wholesale. But this was here. This was San Francisco. America. The 21st century. I had been in that crowd. It had just happened. And yet, life was continuing the way it had. The world didn't stop. No one declared that everything was different now. No one was going to remember September 24th as the day everything changed. If some foreign power, some religious terrorist, had gassed hundreds of thousands of Americans in the streets of San Francisco, they'd be rearranging all the furniture in government to make way for the new agencies that would swoop in to make sure that never again would such a thing happen on U.S. soil. Why did the fact that we'd all bought the gas with our tax dollars make the gas acceptable? I wanted to put this online, but I didn't have the energy to do it all over again. Make another darknet site. Try to get people interested in it. I was about to go back to bed when it hit me. I didn't need to do anything with the darknet this time. This video was ours. Mine and Lemmy's. It wasn't a secret who recorded it or where it was recorded. I laughed. I could stick this on YouTube. I could tweet it from my own account. I'd gotten so used to operating in secret that I'd forgotten that I didn't have to. I posted the video to the Internet Archive, YouTube, and popped a torrent on the Pirate Bay for good measure. Wrote a paragraph explaining that I'd shot this at the demonstration after the Herf event, pasted it in, tweeted it, and crawled beneath the covers. Ange woke me up at 6 a.m. by ringing my phone. When I'd set it up the night before, I'd forgotten to configure it to stay silent before 7 a.m., so the ringing drilled into my ears at Odark 100 and dragged me back from the land of Nod.
"Morning, beautiful," I said.
"You could have told me you had video of the gassing," she said.
"I forgot," I said. I was still half asleep.
There was a long pause at the other end of the line.
"You forgot?" "I forgot I'd made the video." Another silence.
"Okay, under any other circumstances, that would be really lame, but I guess you've been pretty distracted lately. Fine, you get a walk. This time."
Still?
Holy shit, dude, what the hell?
"Are people talking about it?"
"It got a million YouTube views before it got taken down. The archive version's still up, and the torrent's being seeded by about 1,000 people."
"Taken down, huh?"
I tried to find some reservoir of naivete in me that could be surprised to discover that the SFPD had ways of taking down files that embarrassed it. "Temporary injunction," she said. "That's what the YouTube page says. I bet you're going to get a visit from a process server today."
"You think they're going to sue me?"
"Sure," she said. "No recording in a frozen zone, remember?" There'd been a bunch of news stories for years about police departments declaring certain areas to be frozen zones because a major operation was taking place and no press had been allowed.
Frozen zone, my butt. The courts have said that the press can go into a frozen zone.
Are you the press?
Well, 1 million people looked at my video. I'd say the answer is yes.
I could hear her smiling on the other end of the phone. "Well, I agree with you, but you'll have to explain it to a judge if you want to make it stick."
"Great," I said. "I'll get right on that. After I get Jonas elected, sue the SFPD for police brutality and unlawful detention, and rescue two people I don't like very much from the clutches of a band of ruthless international mercenaries."
"You make it sound so hard," she said. "Come on, dude, you're Mikey. And I've got to get my phone number transferred to this new SIM."
"Yeah, that sounds like a total bitch. Phone companies suck. Good thing you've got me."
"I do," I said. "Indeed I do." So, that was that day. Getting the rest of the stuff built for Joe, getting a whole raft of emails from reporters, some of whom I knew from my Mikey days, asking if they could license my video for their networks. I laughed and said, "License schmeissens, it's all over the net, duh." That was good enough for Al Jazeera and Russia Today and The Guardian, but all the big American networks wanted me to sign these release forms saying that if anyone sued them for posting the video, they could sue me for letting them post it. Invariably, these contracts came as non-editable PDFs so that I couldn't delete the offending clauses before signing them. The first 3 times this happened, I just opened the PDFs in a graphics editing program and drew big black boxes over everything in the contract, apart from the bit where I said they could use the video, pasted my signature into the bottom, and filled in the date and sent it back. After that, I stopped bothering. I noticed that most of the networks I gave this treatment to later ended up running the video, sometimes with courtesy of Marcus Yallo underneath, but more often with their big fat logos superimposed over the picture and all rights reserved messages that made me hoot with indignant laughter. My new phone rang at 2 a.m. Like an idiot, I'd forgotten again to apply the setting that turned off the ringer after bedtime. I swiped the answer button. "Ange," I said, "it's the middle of the goddamn night. I love you and all."
"We love you too, Mikey."
It was another one of those text-to-speech voices. This one was female and had a crappy Australian accent. "Goodbye," I said.
"You haven't done anything about Kerry Johnstone,"
a different voice said. This one was male and sounded like Yoda. "You called me to tell me that?" "I already knew that.
Masha and Zeb are depending on you."
The female voice this time. I wondered if there were really 2 people on the call. It could have been 1 guy or 1 woman or 100 people typing into a group-edited page and firing off the results to a text-to-speech engine. "I've done everything I told Masha I would do, and then some. If you want to save her, you should do it yourself."
"We sent you Johnstone's docs,"
the male voice said. "You did."
"Did you look at them?"
This was a new voice, impossibly deep, like a cartoon bullfrog. It had a Texas accent. "No," I lied.
"You should look at them. Johnstone's a very naughty girl. You could tell the world about it. You've got the platform. especially now.
I sat up in bed. Listen, I said, I don't take advice from anonymous strangers. If you've got something to say to me, you can say it to my face. It's easy to sit there in your parents' basements telling me how I should be risking my life. But as far as I'm concerned, you're just another gang of creeps who get their kicks from spying on people.
So much drama, the Australian voice said again. We've handed you Johnstone on a platter. You've got the home addresses of everyone she loves, her social security number, her ex-husband's a criminal record, the institution where her daddy is drawing out from his latest Vicodin binge. You put all that online, you watch how fast she comes around to bargain.
Why would she bargain with me after I put all her secrets online?
Oh, the Yoda voice said. Because she doesn't know what else you have. We told you, Ms. Johnstone's been a very naughty girl. You remember what we did to your computer? You'd be amazed at how many other people's computers we've pwned.
I groaned and pulled my knees up to my chest.
If you guys are all so leet and badass, why don't you do this? Why aren't you destroying Carrie Johnstone?
We are, Marcus. But you are our instrument in this mission. You are the perfect weapon to use to destroy one of the worst people on Earth. You should feel special.
I hung up. Look, you try to get to sleep after a call like that. I'd spent several mesmerized hours staring at Carrie Johnstone's docs already. But being gassed, beaten, shackled, nearly kidnapped, taken into custody, and then released to an insanely busy work situation had managed to drive the details out of my mind. And it wasn't as if I'd gotten through all of them. There were thousands of files in the Johnstone docs. It was like a miniature ship-in-a-bottle version of the Darknet docs. A mammoth library of sleaze and misery blended with a million irrelevant facts, cryptic files, and weird irrelevancies. I'd become a one-man version of the Department of Homeland Security, sitting on top of a haystack the size of the universe, trying to find the needles. I dove back into the Johnstone docks. The conversation with the freaky computer-voiced Anons had rattled me, but it had also intrigued me. I'd had nightmares about Johnstone. And there was something evilly attractive about giving her a nightmare for a change. The conversation had equipped me with some search terms to use on the Trove, and I saw that, yep, her family was pretty screwed up, and that there were a bunch of phone numbers and addresses for relatives. Some of them were important people. There was an uncle who was a judge in Texas. And some were only noteworthy because they were in rehab or had some embarrassing criminal charge in their records. Once I started to search on their names, I saw that a lot of them had received consulting payments from Ziz. And while I didn't know enough about finance to know exactly what that meant, I assumed that it was either a way for Johnstone to rip off Ziz by sending a lot of money to her family, or some kind of slimy money laundering. No reason it couldn't be both, either. There were a few folders of photos. The most disturbing of these were clearly taken by the webcam on Johnstone's computer without her knowledge. In several, she wore only pajamas and a bra, and in one, she had a finger rammed up one nostril to the second knuckle. My first thought was how humiliating it would be to her if I released these pictures. My second thought was to feel sick at the number of pictures like this of me that there had to be floating around, and to wonder what all my robot-voiced friends might do with them if they decided I wasn't on their side. A file called searchterms.txt turned out to be exactly what it sounded like. Everything Carrie Johnstone had plugged into a search engine, harvested from her browser's cache of search queries. I started looking through it and quickly looked away. I hated Carrie Johnstone, but I didn't need to know what kind of breast cancer she was looking into, about her research into antidepressant drugs, or the names of the stars whose nude photos she was searching for. I shook myself like a dog shaking off water and retreated to the emotionally safer distance of all those payments from Ziz. Looking at several different files, I saw that everything that had to do with a payment used the string IBAN, which stood for International Bank Account Number, and had to be specified for wire transfers. From there, It only took a few seconds to produce a list of every file that had to do with payments and start looking through them. I quickly saw that Johnstone controlled and moved a lot of Ziz money, and that her payments went to a lot of political action committees. I wondered if maybe her family was channeling the PAC money as well. A few seconds on the web, and I saw that Johnstone's favorite PACs were big donors to politicians who supported easy debt collection laws, and it clicked. The darknet docs might tell the story of the pressure to wipe out the families of kids with student debt, but here was the smoking gun. The money paid from Ziz to fronts that went on to fatten up politicians who went along with the deal. It was 3 a.m. I had work the next day. It was going to be a big day. There was a pretty good chance all our servers would be taken down by some scary lawyer threat somewhere, and I'd have to have a clear head to fix that. But who the hell could sleep under these circumstances? Who was I kidding? I was up for the count. I took my laptop down into the kitchen and made myself cheese on toast, always my favorite midnight feast, and dithered in front of the coffee machine for 10 minutes, trying to decide whether I should or shouldn't have a cup. If I drank coffee now, I really would be up for the rest of the night. But even if I didn't, I was pretty sure that I wasn't going back to bed, and a little of the old bean juice would sure help sharpen my wits. Who was I kidding? I loaded up the AeroPress and made myself a double, and then made another to keep it company. I sat down at the kitchen table with the machine and kept on reading. I even went back to the pictures. A chat request popped up on my screen. That didn't happen often. Ever since I'd gotten the job with Joe, I'd kept my main ID logged out, and the only handle I left logged in was one that almost no one knew about. Hey, Jolu. Hey, Mr. Night Owl. Good to see I'm not the only one awake at O'Dark Hunterd. Why you up? Fight with Kylie. Oh. I paused. You mean you two are... Kinda. It's complicated. I had no idea that Jolu had any kind of romantic life, though it stood to reason. But Kylie? She was old. Oh, chronologically, she was only a couple years older than us, but she was such a grown-up. She'd run that meeting like a boss. Listen, you want to get a slice of pie? It was the first sensible suggestion anyone had made to me all night. Hell yeah. I'll be there in 15. San Francisco isn't a bad place to get a slice of pie at 3 in the morning. I'm willing to believe that New York might be better, but it's not like we lacked for choice in any event. We ended up in the Tenderloin at one of those 50s retro places that stayed open 24 hours and catered to a weird blend of jet-lagged tourists, hookers, off-duty cops, homeless people and night shifters, and us. I think you should do something really lateral, Jolu said after I had him up to speed. I mean, you've got these two groups of weird-ass crooks hoping to make you jump one way or the other, and they're both calculating your next move to see if they can get inside it, steer it. They're smart, nuts, and totally lacking in ethics. The only way you're going to get ahead of them is by doing something totally, absolutely whacked out. Move to Albania, rappel off the Golden Gate Bridge, become a Trappist monk. That's really helpful, thanks. Oh, come on, it's a major advance on when in trouble or in doubt. Again, this is less than helpful. It's 4 in the morning, cut me a break. This wasn't the first time I'd found myself in an all-night diner with Jolu, and all the nights we'd passed in this kind of place had a certain sameness to them. I'd swear that some of the skeezy drunks and cracked-out weirdos holding down the booths around us were there the last time we'd been here. It's funny how comforting it was to inhabit the sheer weirdness of eating a slice of bad blueberry pie and good ice cream in the middle of the night, sitting next to a guy with a face full of broken veins like a map of the California State Highway System, a crooked nose, and a pink ballerina's tutu around his prodigious middle. Especially when that guy is trading unintelligible drunken remarks with a skinny one-armed guy with a heavily tattooed scalp, bare feet, and long fingernails painted with glitter polish. Marcus, Jolu said. Seriously. This is some bad stuff you've gotten involved with. And you're letting yourself be driven by what other people are doing, instead of choosing a path and making other people decide what to do about you. There's no reason for that. Look at it this way. All these people, the weirdos who rooted your computer, these mercenaries, have a lot of advantages over you. They're organized. They have money. They have technical expertise you lack. Gee, thanks, Jolu. Wait for it. They also have to have meetings to decide what to do next. You can just decide on your own. That means that you can do something, force them all to sit down and figure out their next course of action, and while they're doing that, you can change direction so that by the time they've worked out their response, it no longer replies. They have lots of advantages, but this is your advantage, and you've more or less surrendered it. I thought about it. I couldn't think of anything wrong with his logic. And yet, okay, but there's only one problem. I don't know what to do. The first step to solving the problem is framing the problem, Jolu said with a wise smile. What if you put together a bunch of possible courses of action, all more or less independent of one another, and had them in your pocket metaphorically, so that you could just jump and jive and zig and zag on a moment's notice? Again, I said, it's a nice theory, but it requires me to think up not just one, but several courses of action. That's not so hard, Jolu said. You could publish everything on the Joe Nosfer Senate website, explain what happened, put up Johnstone's docs, and hit save. I winced. Jesus, Jolu, that'd be unexpected, he said. And weird. And a little destructive, though I'd bet that Joe would forgive you. You could dump it all on Barbara Stratford. You could hit your Anon pals up for Carrie Johnstone's passwords and paste bin them, making her life busy as hell for a while, put her on the back foot. You could surrender yourself to the closest Ziz office, demand that they kidnap you, freak them right the hell out, or call the FBI and report a kidnapping, any and all of the above and more. Each one of these gave me a little shiver of excitement and fear. It was just the sort of thing Jolu excelled at, coming up with scary, smart, dumb ideas. I needed to change the subject before he got me too freaked out. So, you and Kylie, huh? He banged his forehead on the table, twice. I'm an idiot. First of all, I was dumb enough to date someone from work. And second of all, I was dumb enough to date someone 100 times smarter than me. She's already figured out that there's only 2 ways this can go if we let it get any more serious. Either we break up and one of us has to leave the company, or we stay together forever. And she wants to know which one it's going to be right now, because she says it's stupid to pretend that this isn't the case, and to be forced into some big emotional scene that we can see coming from here. I boggled. This was so totally different from what Ange and I were like. I mean, she was my girlfriend, but we lived at our parents' houses. She didn't have a job, much less a job working with me, and we were more worried about hacking justice forcibly into American politics than we were about what the future of the relationship might hold. Somehow, while I was off being a debt-stricken college dropout, Jolu had turned into an adult. Are you going to get married? I must have sounded pretty intense because he laughed, and so did the weirdos at the next table. Come on, Margus, I'm 19 years old. That's a little young, but it's not as if I'm a kid anymore. I don't know if I want to get married to Kylie right now, but the idea of getting married isn't the worst one I've ever had. Lots of people do it, you know. I know, I said, but I couldn't find the words. But getting married is for old people. My parents got engaged when they were 18. Like I said, I don't know for sure if Kylie is the person I want to spend the rest of my life with, but there's a good chance she is. I mean, how do you feel about Ange? Are you planning on breaking up with her? No! I mean, of course not. We had a big fight last week, and I was ready to stick my head in the oven. I get sick just thinking about it. There you go, then. You're planning on spending forever with her. You just haven't admitted it. And from what I know about her, she's in the same place. Kylie's 25. She was in a long-term relationship before, and so she knows that there's a point where you've got to fish or cut bait. You make it sound so romantic. There's nothing romantic about pretending you're not heading toward a lifelong commitment. How long are you and Ange going to stay together? It's a question worth asking yourself. And Ange. How come no matter what, we always end up talking about my problems? He grinned. Well, it's always easier to give advice than to take it, duh. So maybe I should give you advice. Margus, you're one of my oldest friends. If you had advice for me, I'd listen closely. And once again, I've managed to put myself on the spot. Yeah, it's one of your most endearing traits. Okay, well, for what it's worth, I really like Kylie. I don't know her very well, but from what I've seen, She seems like really good people. And it sounds like she makes you happy. But Jolu, I fuss with my pie and the spreading ice cream slick beside the cooling slice. Well, buddy, I mean, I think most people today like to spend a while making sure they know each other really well before they commit to forever. It sounds like Kylie thinks you can't afford to do that because if you decide you're not going to keep it up, you'll have to walk away from your job or she will. But what if you promised each other that no matter what, neither one of you will expect the other to quit? I mean, that may be a hard promise to keep, but is it any harder to keep than I promise to marry you and be with you forever until I die? He chewed this over while I felt just a little bit smug. He was right. It was easier to give advice than to get it. Huh, he said. You're not bad. Okay, that's worth a try. Now, what are you going to do? My mood fell. I have no idea, I said. Everything you've told me makes sense, but I don't know where to start. Start at the beginning, he said. Move one step in the direction of your goal. Remember that you can change direction to maneuver around obstacles. You don't need a plan. You need a vector. I finished my ice cream and left the pie. The sun was starting to come up, and Ange would be waking up soon. We'd hardly seen each other that week, and all Jolu's talk about breaking up made me really want to see her. I figured I could go by the Korean walnut cake place she loved and bring over a box and grab a shower and have breakfast with her family before work. As it turned out, Ange's mom had an early appointment and her sister was staying at a friend's place, so we had a rather indulgent time in her bed, replenishing our strength with walnut cakes as required. I had this gnawing feeling that I was going to be late for work, but every time I looked at the clock, it was still ungodly early, and we returned to our business. In the end, I rolled up to work 10 minutes early, grinning like a dirty fool and feeling better than I had in weeks. Jolu was right. I just needed to take a step in the direction I wanted to head and stay flexible enough to keep moving that way no matter what happened. And of all the problems I had, the biggest one was Carrie Johnstone. For so long as she was gunning for me, I couldn't be safe enough to do anything else. I would have to do something about her, and I was going to need Jonas's help to do it. "Where's Joe?" I said. Early as I was, Floor was always earlier. She gave me a searching look, as if trying to figure out what to tell me. Then she seemed to come to a decision. "He's talking to the FBI," she said. "The FBI? Like, the FBI FBI? The guys with the sunglasses and the suits? Those guys?" "Those guys," she said. "Is someone trying to kill him or something?" Floor smiled a little. "Nothing like that. At least not yet. If he goes all the way I think he can, I'm sure that'll come." "No, the FBI wants to talk to him about the documents we're hosting on our website." "Oh." "Of course they did. And once they started talking to him about this, it was only a matter of time until they came to talk to me. And then I'd either have to lie to a bunch of hardcore Fed cops or tell them what was going on. Neither of those are my ideal position." "Does he have a lawyer with him?" Floor smiled again. "Yes, Marcus, he has the campaign's lawyer with him. Harry has known Joe since they were in college together. I'm sure he'll do very well." "Well, that's good," I swallowed. "The campaign has a lawyer?" "Yes, since the beginning. He was one of the people who pushed Joe to run as an independent." "Does that mean that if the FBI wants to talk to the rest of us, that he'll come with?" "Marcus," Floor said, "you work for this campaign. And so, yes, the campaign's lawyer will represent you anytime something you've done in connection with this campaign becomes an issue with law enforcement. But don't worry too much. Joe talked to Harry before he had Liam post those documents. He understood the risks. He's gone to talk to the FBI to preempt them coming around here to talk to the rest of us. It's just part of the job." "Okay," I said. "Thanks." "On the other hand," she said, and I glimpsed the other Floor, the one I'd seen the day I was hired, the slightly scary, stern one. "If you've done something that isn't part of this campaign, something that might make the FBI or some other law enforcement agency want to take some action against you, something that might embroil this campaign in needless controversy, then you will find yourself answering to me, because we've discussed this already, and I believe we have an agreement on this. Am I right?" "Right," I said. I felt sure my guilt was scrawled across my face, but I made myself stay calm and look just slightly to one side of her steady gaze. I sat down at my computer to discover that I was actually a pretty smart guy. Amazon had terminated our hosting in the night. and the system had seamlessly switched us over to our first fallback cloud provider with such grace and speed that none of the uptime monitors had even noticed. That reminded me that I still needed to get my phone number back. If the uptime monitor had squawked, the messages would have gone to my phone, wherever it had disappeared to. And I dialed into the carrier's customer service line and started a timer going, just to see how long it took the rocket scientists at the phone company to take my requests. It had ticked past the 35-minute mark when a shadow loomed over my shoulder, and I turned around to see Joe looking like he'd been through the ringer. I hung up the phone. "Hi, Joe," I said.
"Hello, Marcus.
How are things?"
"Things are complicated," he said. "Perhaps you and I could sit down for a few minutes?"
I knew then that I was about to be fired. "Sure," I said. I locked my computer's screen and followed him into the boardroom and closed the door behind me.
"Let me tell you a few things, Marcus, before we get to chatting, if you don't mind."
"No," I said, feeling that tight, bloodless feeling in my face and extremities. "Not at all."
"First, I believe that my opponents are behind this FBI business. They don't like the attention this has brought to the campaign, so they've put me in the soup with the law. Monroe, in particular, has had a long-standing relationship with Ziz and its subsidiaries through his career in Sacramento. I'm not in the least bit surprised to hear that he's hurting over this and wants to hit us back. Second, I value the work you've done here, and I credit you with coming up with this whole plan. I think you're a bright young man, and I hope you'll stay in touch with me no matter what happens. Third, that said, the FBI say that they're reasonably certain that you aren't just someone who happened to suggest posting these documents to our site. They seem to believe you had something to do with their initial publication. Fourth, I don't know if that's true or not, but in the course of our discussion, we covered several possibilities for what could happen with you in this campaign. In the end, they reluctantly but firmly agreed that if you were no longer formally associated with this office, they would not pursue any further investigations about your role in those documents to date. This was not an easy offer to come by, and in my view, it represents an internal conflict in their upper echelons, who are simultaneously outraged over these leaks and over the intelligence they contain. They don't want another WikiLeaks trial on their hands, especially since this one doesn't have the same national security dimensions of that entire affair. Very little of this material is technically classified, or even secret, and Harry pointed out that the few documents that have surfaced with those labels would likely have been released if they were targeted by a Freedom of Information Act request. But still, they don't like the look of the thing. Here's this young man with a history of what they consider to be antisocial computer use, and he's implicated in both the release and the publication of these documents. They worry that if the story gets out, they'll look incompetent or worse.
But if I get fired, Marcus, I'm not going to fire you. Be clear on that.
But we're talking about optics here, the appearance of the thing. You're right that if you were fired at this juncture, it would make you look more guilty, and it would make me look more foolish. But if you were to, say, go off on your own to pursue private consulting work, then the campaign could pay you a decent retainer for your work to date, a sum more or less equal to what you'd have taken home in the event that you'd worked through to Election Day. You'll be paid your normal salary to the end of the pay period, in exchange for being available to Liam if he needs help getting up to speed on the really excellent systems you've built for us. And should I take office? Well, there's always the possibility that you would find work in my office doing the very consulting you'd set out to do while you were on your own.
I thought you said I wasn't being fired. The anger bubbled in me, made me want to do something stupid. I literally bit the inside of my cheek to keep him from saying anything more. His expression didn't change.
You're not being fired, Marcus. You're not being thrown under the bus, either. That's what the FBI expected of me, you know. They wanted me to turn you over, denounce you as a criminal who'd used my office and its technology to commit your crimes.
That was what my opponents were hoping for, too. He dropped his voice.
The Bureau has some pure fools and vicious idiots in it. But it is not at its core rotten. What's more, even the most foolish, vicious Phoebe at HQ has some self-respect and doesn't want to be used as a game token by scheming politicians who are hoping to score points with the electorate during the midterms. It wasn't easy to broker this deal, and Harry is still surprised we got it out of them. It's the best deal we're likely to get. It's a deal that keeps you from being investigated by the federal police, and one that lets you keep your pay. It does mean you can't keep coming here, and you can't be part of our team. And I promise you, Marcus, that however much you hate that idea, I hate it even more. I think that losing you is going to cost us. And if I get elected, it will be in spite of losing you. I believed every word. When Joe Noss told you something, straight and even, looking you in the eye, you couldn't help but believe him. My anger drained away. I can't take the money, I said. He shook his head once, minutely, but it was a gesture of total negation. That's not optional. You were hired for this job. You were counting on that wage. The political machinations of unethical men and women shouldn't take money out of your pocket. That was money you fundraised for your campaign. Your donors didn't kick it in to pay me not to work for you.
Marcus, that's very big of you, but I anticipate paying that sum out of my own savings. Floor will paper over it. I can afford it.
I'll just donate it back to your campaign.
He sat back, looking suddenly exhausted and beaten. I can't stop you from doing that. But I urge you to give it some thought before you rush into this.
I will, I said. I think I need to go now. The lack of sleep from the night before was catching up with me. Tears were welling up behind my eyes, which was always a sign that I wasn't in my right head. I decided that Joe was right about making up my mind about the money later. I started to wonder how much of a good guy Joe Noss could be when he was ready to fire people for optics and then quietly rehire them later. I think I said thank you, or words to that effect, and stepped wooden-faced into the office. There were always 10 or 15 people in the office, volunteers staffing phones or collating literature, a cluster of desks where the campaign strategist and the speechwriter and the PR guy all sat, people whose job I didn't even know. I'd met them all, but I only knew half of them by name. Now, they were all staring at me, and pretending not to, as I crossed to my desk. There was a cardboard banker's box on my chair, and as I drew up to it, I saw that the few things I'd brought into work had been gathered into the box. I looked at Floor, and she nodded at me and gave me a sympathetic look. I supposed she had packed the box for me, and I supposed that this was a kindness since it let me leave faster. I got into my jacket, slid Lurch into my backpack, picked up my box, and left without saying another word. Leah met me on the sidewalk just outside the office. "Dude," he said, "this is weak." I hated the way Liam talked, but I decided to forgive him. I knew that if I lost my temper, it would be ugly. I wasn't in a good place. "You've got my number, right?" is what I said. "In case you've got any tech problems, you know where the passwords are, too. I'll email you the full server details and customer service info for all the hosts and stuff when I get home." He looked searchingly at my face. I looked back into his eyes. He blinked. "Is it true you were behind the darknet docks all the time?" I didn't say anything. I was tired of lying, but I still reflexively felt that going public about this was a bad idea. I was pretty sure that Kerry Johnstone had been the one to tell Joe's opponents that he had someone working for him who was behind the darknet. She must have figured out that isolating me was the first step to neutralizing me. She was probably right. "Thanks for everything, Liam," is what I said. He studied my face a moment longer. "I don't want the job," he said. "I'm going to quit." "Don't do that," I said. "Why the hell not?" "Because the world will be a better place if Joe Noss is elected to the California Senate than it will be if one of those two other schmucks makes it into office." He barked a laugh. "You're kidding, right?
You really think it makes a difference who we vote for? After you've seen the Darknet docs, seen how someone uses the system to get rich, then uses their riches to change the system to keep them that way? Jesus, Marcus, what is this, high school civics? Come on, bro, you of all people should know better than that. If you really believe that, why were you working for Joe in the first place? It was weird sticking up for the guy who just fired me, especially since I was starting to get pretty pissed off about being fired. I mean, optics? What the hell kind of reason was that to fire someone? The nagging voice in my head told me that it was a perfectly good reason if you were running for office, especially if the person generating the bad optics had lied to you, or at least failed to mention some very important information. It's a job. Who gives a damn? Might as well be flipping burgers or walking dogs. I started to say something about how you shouldn't do a job you don't care about, but I remembered all those months I'd spent knocking on every door I could, handing out resumes like chewing gum, and all the big fat no's that had gotten me. Listen, Liam, I said, but there wasn't anything to say to Liam. The fact was, he was probably right. Forget it, I said. Call me if you need tech support, okay? Yeah, he said. There was a second where we might have given each other a big back-slapping dude hug, but neither of us moved. Liam had looked up to me so much, and it had been nice. But it had also been weird, all that adulation. I had a feeling I wouldn't have to worry about it anymore. Once upon a time, my government turned my city into a police state, kidnapped me and tortured me. When I got free, I decided that the problem wasn't the system, but who was running it. Bad guys had gotten into places of high office. We needed good apples. I worked my butt off to get people to vote for good apples. We had elections. We installed the kind of apples everyone agreed would be the kind of apples we could be proud of. They said good things. A few real dirtbags like Kerry Johnstone lost their jobs. And then, well, the good apples turned out to act pretty much exactly like the bad apples. Oh, they had reasons. There were emergencies, circumstances. It was all really regrettable. But there were always emergencies, weren't there? My whole 19 years on this earth had been one long emergency, according to all the papers and the TV. When would the emergencies finally end? Would there be a day when unicorns pranced through the mission and pronounced an end to hostilities around the world, a return to the promised normalcy with jobs and freedom for all? Hell no! If someone like Joe Noss could turn out to be just another politician, then so could anyone and everyone. Kerry Johnstone had been fired, but she ended up getting more money, more power, and more authority with even fewer checks on her ruthlessness. Kerry Johnstone was always going to end up on top. I'd been an idiot to think that we could elect someone who'd make it all better. I once thought that Liam was an idealistic fool who lacked the sophistication to appreciate just how good it could all be if we just had the right people out there passing good laws and making good government. Now, I saw who the fool was. It was the idiot I saw in the mirror every morning, and I was getting pretty sick of his face. Ange didn't answer emails or IMs and didn't pick up her phone. Who cared? What I was about to do wasn't about her. It was about me. Setting up the first Darknet dock site had taken a fair bit of work. It was a lot easier the second time around, and now I had all of the Johnstone docks in a nice, safe, untraceable place. I wrote a blog post explaining what these docks were, who they belonged to, and even how I'd come by them, gritting my teeth until they hurt, and typing out the admission that I'd been rooted by a gang of anonymous trolls who'd done the same thing to my arch-nemesis. Jolie was right. I'd spent far too long letting Johnstone drive me ahead of her like a terrified, bleeding sheep. It was time I started leading the chase, instead of just running away in terror. I didn't publish the post. I almost did, but I didn't. Instead, what I did was email the post, along with the Darknet link, to PR@zizglobal.com, Kerry.Johnstone@zizglobal.com, and press@zizglobal.com. I copied in webmaster@zizglobal.com for good measure. Practically no one read the webmaster ad account for their domains these days. The address was a spam magnet like no other, but it seemed like a good time to be thorough. I had just hit send and begun to metaphorically crap my pants when Ange called. What's up? I had class. I got fired, Kerry Johnstone told Joe Noss's opponents that I'd been the one behind the Darknet docs, and they called the FBI. Joe negotiated my freedom in exchange for shit-canning me. So I got home and emailed Kerry Johnstone a copy of her docs. I've just sent a copy of the Darknet address to your Tunisian Pirate Party email address. If I go missing, spread it around, okay? Marcus? Yes? What did you just say? I repeated it. That's what I thought you said. There was a long silence. Hello? I'm here. I'm not going to apologize, I said. It's my life. I'm tired of running away. I'm tired of being a stupid idealist. It's time to take charge, time to do something. I'm sorry I didn't talk to you beforehand, but... I wasn't going to ask you to apologize, she said. You don't owe me an explanation. It's pretty clear you don't owe me anything. Don't worry. I'll get that Darknet address and keep it safe and make sure everyone knows about it if you go missing. I'd never heard the tone of voice she was using at that moment. I couldn't tell if she was angry or scared or maybe even proud. Oh, I said. Well, I think I'd better go, she said, and the line cut off. Not proud, then. My parents were both out for a change. Dad was doing some grocery shopping and Mom had a client meeting. The house felt more than empty. It felt hollow. Spooky. Every creak and bang was a squad of Ziz Mercs about to break down my door and kidnap me. And even though I knew that was the one thing they couldn't afford to do now that I had my finger over the button, I was sure I was about to get snatched. Or they'd take my parents or Ange. What had been Jolu's other suggestions for actions I could take? Move to Albania. I didn't even have a valid passport. The one I'd used to go see Mom's relatives in the UK had expired 2 years before. I could dump it all on Barbara Stratford. Well, why not? She'd helped last time. I got my bike out of the garage and set off for the San Francisco Bay Guardian's offices. I was nearly there when my phone rang. The caller ID didn't know the return number. I answered. Yeah? You're some kind of trouble magnet, aren't you? It took me a minute to place the voice. Mostly because I'd internally decided that I'd never hear it again. Masha? You busy? What? From what I can see, you're somewhere by the Embarcadero. Judging from your rate of travel, you're either on a bus that's making a lot of stops or a bicycle. And from what I can see, you're no longer listed as CTO of the Joe Noss for California Senate campaign on their website. So I'm thinking you might not be totally busy. So... how about you turn off your phone altogether, remove the battery, and meet me where your idiot school buddy tried to wrestle me? Do you know the place? The day Masha had disappeared, the first time, she tried to take me with her, and we'd been shadowed by Charles Walker, a drooling gorilla from Chavez High, who would have dearly loved to narc me out to Homeland Security. Masha had kicked his ass, flashed her DHS ID, and threatened to arrest him. It had been on one of the alleys off Jackson, up on Knob Hill. I wasn't exactly sure which one, but I thought I'd recognize it again if I saw it. I know the place. The line went dead. People kept hanging up on me. It wasn't a very pleasant experience. As I pedaled for downtown, I realized I didn't want pleasant experiences anymore. I was done trying to optimize my life for what would make me happy. From now on, I was going to optimize my life for whatever worked at the moment. Happiness was overrated.